Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. If you could listen back to an entire soundtrack of the history of human civilization, what do you think we'd learn about ourselves now in 2018? Noise, A Human History is a 30-part BBC radio series that attempts to answer that question. Made in collaboration with the British Library Sound Archive, the series explores the human dramas that have revolved around sound at various points in the last 100,000 years, allowing us to think in fresh ways about the meaning of our collective past. Today, I want to highlight one of those 30 parts, a look at the new art of listening that swept through popular culture in the 19th century. Professor David Hendy of the University of Sussex explores how the Victorians stopped shuffling and learned to hush, beginning with a nature walk in California.
One gorgeously warm and sunny August day in 1869, the Scottish-born American naturalist John Muir was wandering among the waterfalls, deep rocky valleys, and ancient giant sequoias of the Yosemite National Park in the Californian Sierra Nevada. It was a place he adored, but on this particular day, instead of thoroughly enjoying himself as usual, he was thoroughly distracted, unable to settle or relax. The problem was the behavior of the other people around him.
It seems strange that visitors to Yosemite should be so little influenced by its novel grandeur, as if their eyes were bandaged and their ears stopped. Most of those I saw yesterday were unconscious of anything going on about them, while the sublime rocks were trembling with the tones of the mighty chanting congregation of waters gathered from all the mountains round about, making music that might draw angels out of heaven.
The birdsong, the wind music of the trees, the joyous hum of insects, the glad streams singing their way to the sea. All were freely available to be seen and heard, perhaps especially to be heard. For as Muir once wrote, even the blind must enjoy these woods. Yet most visitors, busy catching fish, distracted by each other's company, driving animals away with their chatter, simply weren't able to appreciate them. If only, Muir wrote, they could be devout, silent, open-eyed, looking and listening with love, their lives would surely be so much richer. John Muir's call for a devout and silent form of listening echoed a cry which reverberated across the 19th century, a need for the sublime power of particular sounds to be experienced to their full. Romantics, like Samuel Taylor Coleridge, had written of the thunders and howlings of the breaking ice, one winter's night on the lake of Ratzeburg, sounds more sublime than any sight can be. William Wordsworth had even written a whole poem on the power of sound. For the romantics and naturalists such as John Muir, this reverence for close listening was reasonable, organic, even rather democratic and liberating. But it also contained the seeds of an attitude to sound that would become darker and more authoritarian as the century progressed. Bayreuth's magnificent Festival Theatre Opera House in Germany, finished in 1876, was one of the world's great temples of music, dedicated to Richard Wagner, a place of worship. As Cosima Wagner admitted, our art, I dare say it, is religion. Only a century before, listening to music, even classical music, had been a pretty relaxed affair, mostly because people weren't actually listening at all. Concerts were held in restaurants. And even if musicians performed in stately homes, it was often as an agreeable backdrop to people dining and flirting and gossiping. In the opera houses, there was no firm etiquette about audience members arriving or leaving on time. Many, in fact, would be chatting away throughout the performance. And all around, there'd be servants hawking carafes of wine or oranges. And in the remote corners of the upper balconies, there would probably be prostitutes plying their trade. The musicians themselves were so used to all this wherever they played that silence was rather unsettling. And when Mozart performed in Vienna in 1781, he wrote to his father saying how pleased he was that he heard screams of bravo while he was still playing. Silence was a sign of rejection. Music, though, was also now thought of as something capable of offering a sublime and deeply personal experience. The French writer Georges Sand explained how she responded to Beethoven's music.
Beethoven makes you enter once again into the most intimate depths of the self. Everything you have felt, experienced, your loves, your suffering, your dreams, all are revived by the breath of his genius and throw you into an infinite reverie.
What, though, did treating music in this reverential way mean for the ordinary music listener? A clue can be found in a painting. Right at the end of the 19th century, it became something of an international sensation, travelling from country to country in the form of popular engravings. I'm looking at a photograph of Leonello Balestrieri's painting, A Beethoven Sonata. It shows a pianist and a violinist playing in a small, sparsely furnished room to an audience of five people. There are two men who are staring intently in the direction of the musicians, though really looking through them rather than at them, as if they're hardly there. There's another man leaning against a wall, looking down. A fourth man who's sitting, bent forward, head in hands and eyes covered, and a woman who's staring into space, transfixed. These are not just people who are silent. They're unconscious of the world around them. They've been swept away to some spiritual realm, as if listening were a sacred task. Worshipful silence was being depicted on canvas because it was now the ideal form of listening. Silence wasn't the same as passivity. It had an intensity to it. It was work. The listener was engaged in a monumental lifelong task of self-realisation and cultural improvement. And this meant, of course, that anyone who shattered the silence would be guilty of destroying the purity of the moment upon which this hard task depended. So yes, weep as you listen. Indeed, why on earth would you not, given how beautifully a piece of music would evoke the depths of despair or the heights of love? But weep quietly. Let a tear roll down your cheek rather than wail out loud. Across Europe and America, silence started to be enforced. In 1808, audiences in Frankfurt were issued with these printed instructions.
During literary or musical performances, everyone is asked to refrain from speaking. Applause, too, expresses itself better through attentiveness than the clapping of hands. Signs of disapproval are not to be expected. Dogs are not tolerated.
The guidelines obviously had only a limited success. 85 years later, audience members were still being asked to refrain from leaving their seats during or before the conclusion of a piece. In New York, in 1857, the Philharmonic Orchestra tried another approach, encouraging concertgoers to start policing themselves.
The remedy lies with the audience itself. If each little neighborhood would take care of itself and promptly frown down the few chance disturbers of its pleasures, perfect order would soon be secured.
By century end, the ideal of decorum was taking hold. People stayed frozen in their seats, trying desperately not to rustle their programs, scarcely daring to breathe. At the new Bayreuth Concert Hall, the orchestra was consigned to a deep pit out of the audience's sightlines. House lights started to be doused when a performance began. All that mattered was a disciplined focus on the sights and sound that Wagner had conjured up. It was precisely at this point that applause became wilder and demands for encores more frequent. That wall of rapturous noise which now met the climax to a piece was the sound of long-suppressed emotion exploding. How could every single person conform to such rigorous standards of behaviour? The answer, of course, was that they couldn't. And this, too, was part of the whole point of this new art of listening. To be able to keep still and listen showed you were an altogether more refined person, not just sensitive to the emotions of music, but, well, a person of class. Ironically, it wasn't always the hoi polloi and the cheap seats who failed to measure up. At the Paris Opera, those who kept on talking regardless of convention were the braying aristocrats with their powdered wigs in the boxes. In Frankfurt, too, the request for audience members not to leave their seats early was addressed not to the stalls, but to those in the boxes. The listening revolution represented a triumph not for aristocratic, but for middle-class codes of conduct. Those who still nurtured the spirit of the Romantics railed against the sheer, stuffy artificiality of concert etiquette. People like Charles Lamb.
I have sat through an Italian opera till, for sheer pain and inexplicable anguish, I have rushed out into the noisiest places of the crowded streets to solace myself with sounds which I was not obliged to follow and get rid of the torment of endless, fruitless, barren attention. I take refuge in the unpretending assemblage of honest, common life sounds.
It wouldn't be long before many ordinary concertgoers sought the raucous delights of the music hall. Undivided silent attention went against that basic human impulse we've come across so often in this series, the instinctive and enjoyable need to hum along, tap our feet, drum our fingers, or sway our hips whenever a piece of music invades our body. Even so, the Victorian era had charged the very act of listening with extraordinary significance. It's one reason its literary culture was mesmerised by blindness. Elizabeth Barrett Browning explained why the central character in her epic poem Aurora Leigh was blind. "He has to be blinded," she said, "to be made to see." People were even being urged to look beyond the surface of things by scientists, such as the physicist Oliver Lodge.
"Matter alone is what appeals to the senses. Yet our animal senses give us no clue or indication to the wealth of existence operating in the intangible and the unseen."
In Oliver Lodge's case, a deep fascination with what could be heard rather than seen led to his lifelong dabbling in the hocus-pocus of telepathy and spiritualism. But it was also what led him to greater scientific understanding of electricity and, eventually, to sending the first radio messages through the air. It was as if the human ear was slowly being perfected, as if its ability to discern the sublime or even the hidden scientific truths of the world was now more acute than ever. But in the end, having sensitive ears would turn out to be not just a gift, but a curse.
Pick up where that installment of the series Noise, A Human History leaves off at bbc.co.uk. Noise, A Human History is written and presented by Professor David Hendy of the University of Sussex. It's produced by Matt Thompson and was originally a Rocket House production for BBC Radio 4, broadcasted in the UK in 2013. You can listen to all 30 parts of the series on the BBC's website or read it all in David Hendy's book, Noise, a Human History of Sound and Listening from Echo Press. You're listening to The Spot on 91.7 KALW, a weekly showcase of the best from podcasts and independent radio producers. I'm Ashleigh-Ann Krickbaum. The concert hall is still my preferred way to listen to music, live with a group of humans around me. But I can't bring the concert hall into my super tiny backyard. This is the Bay Area, after all. So for home listening, I prefer records. And for travel, I have to settle for MP3s. Almost all of us do, whether we like it or not. The STEM podcast Transistor takes the time to explore just what is happening to a piece of music as it's transformed from studio tape into a bite-sized MP3, and just what can be lost in that process. Here's reporter Emily Richardson Lorente.
When software to compress music into MP3 files first came out, this Ace of Base song was number one in the US. Back then, hard drives were tiny, and the easiest way to share music with a friend was to bring a CD to her house. But with the advent of the MP3 format, there was finally an easy way to send and store music digitally. Sure, that music was highly compressed, and yeah, lots of people have since complained about the quality, but there's one guy who's not complaining.
Oh, I'm feeling great about it.
That's Karl-Heinz Brandenburg, the proud father of the MP3. The method he and his team perfected for compressing music allows us to squeeze a big, beautiful, complex symphony into an itty-bitty compressed digital file a tenth its original size. Like any digital audio file, the MP3 converts sound into data, tiny packets of code called bits. The fewer bits you use in a song, the more you compress it, the smaller the file. But just cutting bits across the board can make for a lousy copy of a song. The trick to any great compressed audio file is to assign more bits to the important sounds and fewer bits to the unimportant ones. The genius behind the MP3 format is that it does this by basically replicating what happens in our ears naturally. It's called auditory masking.
If you walk into a big train station and a train comes in and you've been talking to somebody, you'll find that the sound of the train will be so loud that you can't hear the other person speaking.
So your friend's voice is masked by the train.
Masking is used in MP3 in a way that the inaccuracies, because I use less bits, become inaudible compared to the original signal.
To hear how this masking concept applies to music, ask Ryan McGuire.
Hello. Check.
He's getting his PhD in composition and computer technologies, so he knows auditory masking.
Let's say there are two sounds happening at once. There's a clarinet and an oboe playing the same note, and one's louder and one's a little bit softer. If the one instrument is loud enough over the quiet one, you can really just erase the quiet one, and most people won't notice that it's gone.
So the MP3 works by essentially reducing the sounds we wouldn't hear anyway, which got Ryan McGuire thinking about what those sounds were.
I'm just sort of fascinated by them. I think this idea of reducing the data by 90% in an audio file and then it's still sounding pretty good is kind of an amazing feat of engineering. And I'm very curious about what those lost sounds are.
So in addition to composing his own original music, like what's playing now, Ryan conceived of a project he calls The Ghost in the MP3.
It's very spooky.
Using a song that Karl-Heinz Brandenburg had used in the original MP3 development listening tests, Ryan began comparing the MP3 versions to the original uncompressed file.
I've been working on the song Tom's Diner.
I am sitting in the morning at the diner on the corner. I am waiting at the counter for the man to pour the coffee. And he.
Oh, no, it's going to be in my head all day.
Yeah, it is an earworm, isn't it?
At the window at somebody coming in.
That's the exact 20 seconds we used for testing.
How many times do you think you listened to Tom's Diner while you were developing the MP3?
Easily thousands, I would say.
But before Dr. Brandenburg heard Tom's Diner for the very first time, he had already spent 5 years developing the MP3.
From the testing available, I thought, oh, now it's pretty good.
But then he tried compressing the a cappella song.
Susan Vega's voice really got destroyed.
I am sitting in the morning at the diner on the corner.
It sounded like she had too much whiskey the day before.
That was in 1988, and it took Dr. Brandenburg and his team another 4 years of trial and error before they were finally satisfied with the sound quality of the MP3. Compression still removed a significant portion of the data, but the difference, the lost sounds, were virtually undetectable to industry experts, the so-called golden ears.
Golden ears who have done listening tests on this and completely liked the audio quality.
Of course, nowadays, some people insist that they can hear a difference in quality with MP3s. And to that, Dr. Brandenburg says,
okay, to get better quality, use higher bitrate.
Remember those bits we talked about earlier? Bit rate is the number of bits in a file transmitted per second. The quality of an MP3, of any kind of digital audio file, really, will vary drastically depending on this number. But in general, the higher the bit rate, the better it sounds. But let me give you an example. This song is about to go from a high bitrate of 256, which is what iTunes currently uses, all the way down to 8 kilobits per second. See what I mean? Unless you're making art with this stuff, you probably want to stick with high bitrates for your music. Okay, back to Ryan McGuire.
Okay.
23 years after the invention of the MP3, he's on a sort of sonic archaeology expedition to uncover the sounds that are lost during MP3 compression.
You know, this is all this material that's been discarded that pretty much everybody is in agreement we don't need.
Ryan calls that material ghosts, and you'll understand why when you hear this.
I am sitting in the morning at the diner on the corner.
Oh, that's so creepy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of terrifying. When I first rendered the first file after I had done this calculation to figure out what was tossed out, and I listened back to it, I had this little sort of eureka moment where I heard it and I thought, oh my goodness, this is really interesting sounding. I could really make music out of this.
And so he did. It's called Modernist.
She's in this diner and she's like staring at her cup of coffee, and she's like in her own little tiny sort of space, you know? And if you're listening on headphones, it's all like, it's all mixed very close in. But then at one point, she's like looking out at this church and she's hearing the bells that are happening outside and the rain outside.
Ryan could make music from the lost sounds in any MP3 if he wanted to. But right now, he's working his way carefully through the 4 songs that Karlheinz Brandenburg used during the MP3 development listening tests. Fast Car by Tracy Chapman is the second.
Fast Car is different from Tom Steiner in that there's a whole band playing. There's less silence and there's more activity. It's more alive in a way.
Which means it also has more ghosts. Oh, that sounds like some sort of post-apocalyptic marching band.
There's a lot more happening.
So those are the ghosts. And here's what Ryan made from them. It's called Any Place. What do you think Karlheinz Brandenburg would think about the work you're doing?
I could see him taking it badly, possibly, and saying, like, you know, well, the MV3 is based on this perceptual model that all the stuff that gets taken out is not perceptible, and so I don't, you know, I don't see the point. My hope is that he'll think it's interesting.
That's very interesting. The ghost in the MP3 taking signals from MP3 and using that to create new art. I think that's marvelous.
Of course, as with any technology, there are trade-offs with MP3s. Sounds are lost, whether or not you and I can hear them. But by unearthing those ghosts, Ryan McGuire is turning digital artifacts into art. If you're interested in hearing more of his work, check out theghostinthemp3.com. His songs are available there as uncompressed files, or if you prefer another option, as MP3s. I'm Emily Richardson Lorente.
This story was produced in 2015 for PRX's STEM Story Project, and you can hear it along with more STEM reporting on the Transistor podcast. Check it out at transistor.prx.org and download it wherever you prefer to listen to your podcasts. That's all we have for you today on The Spot. You can find more episodes at kalw.org. Send your recommendations of podcasts as well as local producers you think we should talk to on our show in an email to thespot@kalw.org. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum, and thanks for listening. Tune in next week for another episode only on 91.7 KALW.